Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Remember, you can always find past editions of this program online, and I think those podcasts are going to come in pretty handy this week. Well, I should say the podcast of this show you're listening to right now is going to come in handy because you might want to refresh your memory before next week. I think most of the veterans I've had on the program over the years could probably have taken up more than the hour that this show provides for them to remember experiences from World War II. But with this veteran today, I just could not squeeze it all into 1 hour. So I'm going to warn you up front, or maybe it's not so much a warning as a promise that you're going to be excited about. But my conversation with Louis Zamperini will continue into next week's edition of Hometown Heroes. I don't do that very often, but I really need to in this case. Most of the time, the men and women that I spend the hour with are people that you've probably never heard of before. And that's part of the whole idea behind this show, that no matter where your hometown might be in this great country of ours, there are heroes all around you, brave Americans who, at one point or another, were willing to put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. In the case of Louis Zamperini, this 94-year-old, yes, 94-year-old wonder has survived more close calls than just about anybody I've ever encountered. I really mean it. Maybe his is a name that you've actually heard if you've been watching TV or listening to the radio lately. Certainly if you've been reading, maybe you've caught a minute or two here or there of Louis's story. My hope is that this interview with Louis will give you a chance to go a little deeper into a story that really is so incredibly remarkable. It has become a New York Times bestseller by the same author who wrote Seabiscuit, Laura Hillenbrand. In fact, this past week, that book, Unbroken, about Louis Zamperini, went back up to number one on the bestseller list for nonfiction. That's a list that it's been on for the last 14 weeks now. In addition to that book, Unbroken, you'll find links on our website, kmjnow.com, to Louis' autobiography, The Devil at My Heels, as well as a remarkable video piece, the same video piece that first turned Laura Hillenbrand onto Louis' story more than a decade ago when the Winter Olympics were in Nagano, Japan. We're going to go full speed ahead with Louis in just a few moments, but here's a little nutshell version of what you'll hear throughout this hour and next week's program. You'll hear this razor-sharp 94-year-old describe close calls he had as a child that earned him the nickname Lucky Louis well before any of these other experiences. We'll hear how he made the Olympic team in 1936 as a distance runner and how the way he performed in Berlin actually captured the attention of none other than the Führer himself, Adolf Hitler. Perhaps most remarkably about his Olympic experiences, the one-of-a-kind souvenir that he daringly brought home. This one you're going to find hard to believe. Louis will cover the disappointment of the games being canceled in 1940 when he was bigger and faster and stronger and ready to compete. He'll also talk about his service as a bombardier on a B-24 crew that nearly cost him his life so many times, including the crash that did claim the lives of 8 of his fellow crew members. Louis and 2 others somehow survived that crash, and he'll tell you how his USC Trojan class ring actually helped save his life. He'll tell us how he survived 47 days lost at sea. And if you listen to this show, you've heard other sailors who were stranded at sea. None of them were floating around for 47 days, but Louis was, and he was cooking up imaginary meals as he floated on a bullet-riddled raft. Eventually, he was captured by the Japanese, spent more than 2 years in captivity. He was tortured. He was beaten. But as the title of that best-selling book implies, Louis remained unbroken by all of it. He'll talk about his liberation and from that to the incredible work that he's done since World War II, even returning as a missionary to the country that I think we'd all agree he had every earthly reason to despise. So if that's not enough to whet your listening appetite, there's even more. We're also going to hear by the second installment of this two-part interview with Louis from a fellow Olympian of his, a fellow USC alum of his, who has been so moved by Louis Zamperini's story that he has partnered with him for speaking engagements. Maybe you would be interested in actually booking that pair for a speaking engagement to your group. If you've heard this show before, you know that I always get excited about all the veterans who sit down in front of the microphone. but maybe you can hear an even higher gear in my voice today, because this really is just one of those one-of-a-kind stories that just simply makes you say, wow. Before long, this story, Louis Zamperini's story, is going to be a major motion picture. But today, it's just you, me, and lucky Louis Zamperini. So we'll take a short break, and then we'll dive into that conversation. This is Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. If you listen to the program regularly, you know what it's all about. Each week we visit with World War II veterans, and the idea is to honor them for their service, for the sacrifices that they've made for the sake of our freedom, to preserve their stories for posterity, and maybe along the way learn a thing or two, be inspired by how much our greatest generation loves our country. And I am thrilled today to welcome lucky Louis Zamperini to the program, 93 years young, and I do mean young. Louis, how you doing today?
Well, I'm doing okay. I just turned 94.
I shorted you. You're 94
years old.
Yeah,
January 26.
Young. That's right. January 26. 94 years old. I bet you don't feel a day older, do you?
Oh, I feel pretty good. I'm mentally alert and sharp, and I'm very fortunate.
Now, I understand you earned the nickname Lucky Louis long before your time in World War II.
Well, yeah, I guess I've had a lot of narrow escapes where I probably should have been killed a dozen times. And that's why they call me Lucky Louis. In fact, the French just redid my book, Devil at My Heels, but they changed the name to Death is My Companion. It's a brand new book. Death is My Companion. Well, that's not my companion.
No, you're still alive and well.
My companion.
Amen. And I think someone else is your companion, and I know you're going to tell us about that by the time the show is over. Louis just mentioned his book, Death at My Heels, or A Devil at My Heels, and now Death is My Companion, that the French changed it to. And you may have heard about another book that's been atop the New York Times bestseller list for months now, Unbroken, the story of Louis Zamperini. Louis, I know you were born back east in upstate New York, but you moved to California as a boy. And I guess you were a pretty good runner from the get-go, huh?
Well, I was the first race I had. I guess I was just 3 years old in Long Beach. I just moved into Long Beach from Olean, New York, from the cold climate to the warm climate. And a kid challenged me to a race, and he beat me, and he ran across the street and was hit by a car and mangled. And so that was my first loss. Then I had another race a couple of years later in Torrance when we moved there, and this kid challenged me to a race across the street, and I lost that one, and he was hit by a car. So, you know, I was lucky I wasn't fast.
Yeah, I guess that's a situation where it's good not to be the fastest. But soon you would be the fastest. They started calling you Zamp the Champ around Southern California. You ended up at USC, and in 1936, you made the U.S. Olympic team. You go over to Berlin, and now, of course, this Olympics is famous to everyone. Everyone recalls Jesse Owens and his four gold medals there and the way Hitler handled that. But for you, as a young teenager, 1936, going to Berlin for the Olympics, what do you remember about that experience?
Well, first of all, I hadn't planned on the Olympics because I was too young, and there were five great milers in the nation. I didn't know I couldn't beat them. But my brother had me switch to the 5,000 meters, which in those days they didn't want kids to run that far. And I ran against the second best guy in the nation. And my brother just said, I just want to see how close you can get to him. Well, I passed him on the home stretch. I got about 10 yards ahead of him. And I would have won the race easily, but a kid from San Pedro was in the first lane. We were lapping him, and the officials were so excited about the race, they motioned him off the wrong way. He ran right in front of me, and I kept trying to pass him and ran clear over to the eighth lane. And I went down on one knee, got up, and my opponent now is ahead of me, and I caught him again, and he beat me about an inch. But anyway, on the strength of that performance, I got an invitation to the Olympic tryouts.
And, of course, you would make it on the Olympic team and head across the pond to run the 5,000 meters. But I understand you had a little bit too much fun on the way across the Atlantic.
Yeah, well, first of all, to make the Olympics, I'm running against the world record holder in the 5,000 meters and the 2 mile, mm-hmm. especially the 2 mile. And we came in a dead heat, so that was a big thrill. That put me on the team, and of course, during the Depression, we used to forage for food. We were so hungry, and there was no unemployment was bad. And but I got aboard a ship, and I'm stunned. I can't believe the food they kept bringing to the table. I mean, they just kept bringing stuff, and so my gold medal was to see how much I could eat before I got to Berlin. I gained 14 pounds, and that was too much.
14 pounds on one little cruise across the Atlantic.
Yeah, and then when I got to Berlin, I thought, I'm going to work it off. But then they have this beautiful village. They had a semicircle, two-story building, and each door was a door to every nation's cuisine. And so I had to try them all.
Well, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I couldn't keep up the pace in the 5,000 meters. And so I'm way behind, 50 yards behind the leading pack. I'm in the second pack of guys. But in the last lap, I thought, oh, man. But my brother always told me, he said, he was a coach, he said, everybody's tired the third lap of the mile. But think of it this way. Just open up and run your guts out, because isn't 1 minute of pain worth a lifetime of glory? So I sprinted the whole last lap, and of course it brought the grandstand up to see a runner gaining 50 yards on the leader.
Mm-hmm.
And I came down the home stretch with the first pack, but I only got eighth place. But then it was in the papers that I ran the last lap in a blistering 56 seconds, which is unheard of. And then as a result of that, I got Goebbels, I guess it was, came over from the officers. German officers were between Hitler and the American team.
Right.
And he said, Hitler wants to see you. I said, hey, I didn't win a gold. He said, well, he wants to see you. So I went over, and he just said, the boy with the fast finish, a late handshake, and that was it. So I guess it was exciting to see someone gain 50 yards, even though I didn't win anything.
Well, it sounds exciting to me, and if I had been announcing that race, I think I would have been going crazy watching you sprint past them.
And by the way, Jesse Owens and Mac Robinson, they were my roommates in the village.
Mm.
They're great guys, both of them, and Jesse Owens especially, he was a prince.
Did you have, I mean, I don't want to get too far away from your story, because it's so incredible, but with the story of Jesse Owens and that Olympics and the snub by Adolf Hitler, was that something that you were aware of that had an impact
well,
on you at
Jesse
the time?
Well, Jesse Owens was, people loved Jesse Owens, even though they never met him, because nothing got him down. If people made a racial remark, he'd just say, hey, it's not my problem, it's their problem. And so as he came in, when Hitler came in the stadium, they were, by orders, had to stand up and cheer him. But when Jesse Owens came in, he got twice the ovation that Hitler got. And because of that, I think Hitler hated blacks, and especially Jesse Owens.
Well, I certainly understand that. I guess you ran that last lap at about Jesse Owens' sprint speed, too.
Yeah, I wish.
Well, and this is before, obviously, no one at that point, certainly from the West, had any idea of how evil Hitler really was and the things that he had planned, the things that he would carry out. What was your sense at the time of meeting this dictator?
Well, because the entire nation was military, we knew something was going on, and we figured he'd probably take over some country in Europe, and his plans were to take over the world. And I think we waited too long, but nobody wants to get involved, you know, the money and a war. It's always too late. Then you have to get involved, and then you got a real problem. Same thing happened with Japan. They were building an empire across the Pacific. Everybody knew. Every school kid was taught in history class that they're moving fast all over east, and they've already come as far as the Marshall and Gilbert Islands. What's the next island? The next island would be Hawaii. And about 7 months before Hawaii was hit, they put out a bombing notice in four languages, which we brought back copies of that, warning people what to do in case of a bombing attack. Well, who else could bomb Hawaii but Japan?
Makes
Nobody
sense
else.
To me.
So it's kind of a ridiculous thing, and people got suspicious that the people in high office knew something, and they didn't let the public know.
We're talking to Louis Zamperini, 94 years young. He lives in Southern California. Back in 1936, he was in Berlin for the Olympics with the American Olympic team, finished eighth in the 5,000 meters. And then, of course, you don't go home immediately after the race. And there are a lot of elements of your story, Louis, that are really incredible and hard to believe. But this one's right up there with them. You got a very unique souvenir after you were done running in Berlin. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, they had what they call beer automats. And the smallest beer they served in Germany was about a liter. So we put down a couple of beers and walking down the street, and I was standing in front of the chancellery, and I thought, what a beautiful building with these groins and pillars. And then I noticed all the beautiful flags flying from the top of the building. Those were long satin-like flags. You could never get near them. But then I saw a smaller flag down on the front wall, and I saw the guards walking back and forth. I timed them, and I had plenty of time to get across the street, get that flag, and get away. But when I got there, the flag was higher than I had anticipated. And then the guards did reach the corner. When they turned around and saw me, they began to scream in German, and I knew they were mad. But I jumped up, clutched the flag in my hand, and ripped it from the pole. And then I did what I do best, and that's run. And then I heard a crack like a rifle shot. And the word halt was saying, well, I didn't need an interpreter for that. And so I halted, and they came up, and they spun me around rather rudely until they saw the American and Olympic flag on my coat pocket. And then they start talking to each other. And then the one officer who spoke very poor English, but I could understand him, he said, but why did you tear down the swastika, you know? And I said, well, I just wanted to take it home to America with me to always remind me of the wonderful time I had in your country. Well, he couldn't refuse, so he went inside, evidently talked to von Fritz, because I remember when he came out, I remember the word Fritz.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was told to let me have the flag, so I still have it.
You still have that flag?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been, people come in and photograph it all the time, and... it's been on a lot of TV shows.
Yeah, you've been a very popular guy lately, and I'm thrilled about that. 75 years you've had that flag now. That's hard to believe. And you made it back to the States, of course, after that. And I know that you enlisted you're a cadet in the Army Air Corps initially. Then you were drafted into the Army. But what happened after that? How did you end up back in the Army Air Corps?
Well, first of all, I trained not for Berlin. I was aiming for the 1940 Tokyo Olympics. Well, of course, we were all in great shape. All the Olympians were looking forward to that Olympics in Japan. And then it was canceled because Japan was at war all over the East. And then Norway was supposed to pick it up, but then the war in Europe, they couldn't do that. So it was a heartbreaker. It was pretty hard to take when you train 4 years for one event. But then when Pearl Harbor was hit, it was a different story. Everybody forgot, and the athletes forgot about being athletes. They wanted to get in to get it over with as soon as possible. And so most guys that I know of just volunteered. We didn't wait for a draft. And we ended up in the Air Corps.
And you would end up on a B-24 crew?
Yeah, we were up in 1-8 Washington. Winnetka, Washington, waiting for our planes to come in, and we were hoping for B-17s because the B-24 was known at that time as the flying coffin. So, then in comes all these B-24s, and our hearts just sunk. And, of course, if you read the book, Unbroken, you'll realize how many B-24s, more were lost in training than combat.
Right. And the B-24, another nickname it has, the Flying Anvil. I don't know what's more intimidating, the Flying Anvil or the Flying Coffin.
Well, it's the plane is it did the job. It carried twice the bomb load of the B-17, and it was about 30 miles an hour faster. And so in the Pacific, they brought back all the B-17s because they couldn't fly to these far off islands, and so we all had B-24s. Now, we took 26 of these B-24s and flew from Midway to Wake Island, bombed it, and flew back. And no plane in the world could do that at that time but a B-24. And then our missions were like, we'd have to fly like 1 or 2 days to our mission. In Europe, they'd get to the target in an hour or two.
And you guys had these long missions, but I guess for you, endurance was never an issue, huh?
What was never an issue?
Endurance.
I didn't hear that.
Endurance. If you're a 5,000-meter rudder.
Oh, yeah. Well, on the B-24, it's a noisy plane, and the Pratt & Whitney motors, because everything's exposed. After the war's over, you got what they call Pratt & Whitney ears, so my hearing isn't that good because of the many, many hours we spent listening to those motors.
And that first mission that you had, or I guess not the first mission, you talked about bombing Wake Island, but I understand there was a mission not too long later where your B-24 got shot up pretty good.
Yeah, this was the Nauru raid. Now, this was the greatest concentration of nitrate in the world, bird droppings over millions of years, and the Japanese needed that for fertilizer and making bombs, and so they had it well fortified. We sent 26 bombers over, and we were in the lead group, and our job is to knock out the ACAC and stuff like that.
Right.
But by going over first, we got the worst of it, and my final bomb hit their supply depot, which smoke shot in the air about 8,000 feet, and all their fuel was burned up, and because of that, I think out of 9 zeros that took off, 3 of them attacked us and wouldn't let us go. And I think the reason they were so persistently after us is because they knew that our bombs blew up their fuel supply. And so we had a running battle for several minutes, and the Japanese zeros came in so close they couldn't miss us. And also, they were in so close we couldn't miss them. So we finally shot down all 3 zeros, but not before taking on five cannon holes in the plane.
Oof.
Right tail shot off. A hydraulic tank was blasted, so we had no power for the flaps and everything else. We had to use a crank and crank them down. And we had 7 guys laid out. 1 died. And but the 4 officers, the navigator, pilot, co-pilot, myself, we were untouched. But I pulled 1 guy off of the catwalk. Now, the bomb bay doors wouldn't close because the hydraulic tank was blowing up.
Right.
And so I walked back there, and I found the radio man on the catwalk, which is about 14 inches wide, and he was just laying there with 1 leg hanging out 8,000 feet above the ocean.
Ooh.
And he just looked up at me, and I pulled him back up on the flight deck, and I'm underneath the upper turret now. And the upper turret, his foot was level with my head. I gave Brooks a shot of morphine, and then he was trying to say something. I couldn't understand, and I bent over. Just as I bent over to listen to him, I heard a loud crack, and a 20-millimeter went through the radio compartment and shattered the upper turret gunner's leg and foot.
Oh.
But if I hadn't bent over, it would have hit me right in the head.
Wow.
So that was really, when I think about it, I just bent over to listen to him, and the blast went right where my head was and hit Pillsbury in the foot and his leg.
Talk about a close call. Holy moly.
My service in Pacific was one close call after another.
It sure sounds like it. And what amazes me about that mission, you came down in that B-24, and you're the bombardier, and you're explaining what you did to try to help your crewmate there. You guys actually landed that plane with 600 bullet holes in it?
Well, what happened, they had a submarine, I believe it was called the Drum, 20 miles on course towards our island. But with a running battle with those 3 zeros, we passed that point. We're supposed to land on the water, and the submarine will pick us up. But we're way past that point, and now the 4 motors are humming pretty good. So but the rest of the plane was a mess. But we had it, so we decided to take a chance and get it back to Funafuti. The pilot, the plane was so badly shot up, the pilot and co-pilot had both their hands and their knees on the yoke or the steering wheel to keep the plane from stalling because of all the damage. And we had 600. A fragmentation of bullet holes in the plane, plus 5 cannon holes. And we got back, and the plane kept porpoising. So we had to come in low and hot. This was a short runway, and you go right off the end of the runway, and we had no brakes. And so I had two parachutes tied to the waist, one in each window, and when we landed, I was going to deploy those chutes and stop the plane. And I guess that's the first time it was ever supposed to be tried. But later, somebody else did it, and it does work. And then they use that for space shuttle and all that stuff. But anyway, we got back, and we came in low and hot. And when we hit the runway, I thought, man, we're going to go off the end. But just as we touched down, the plane ground looped to the left. Well, what happened, one of those 20-millimeter shells had gone through the front of the airplane into the wing between the number one and number two motor, and actually penetrated the tire. So thank God the tire was flat, because it caused us to ground loop. And now we're ground loop off of the runway with four motors going, and there's a bomber coming towards us with four motors going. This is really weird. And then the co-pilot knew we had no brakes, but he inadvertently pushed the brakes, and there was enough fluid in the brake well to cause it to lock momentarily, and that caused us to ground loop to the right. And so if he hadn't done that, we'd have gone straight into the other bomber, and both planes would have blown up.
Sure sounds like somebody was looking out for you that day.
That's what somebody said. You know, somebody up there loves you. I said, well, I'm glad somebody does.
Well, and if any of our listeners know anything about your story, they know that we haven't heard anything yet. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll hear the even closer calls and the even more horrific experience that Louis Zamperini endured, the story that he has to share with you today at age 94. Louis Zamperini, our guest today. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Louis Zamperini. If you've been paying attention, you've probably seen his smiling face, or maybe you've read one of the books about him. His own book is still available. You can find it online. And if you go to our website, kmjnow.com, I'll have all the links up there for you for any book about Louis Zamperini, as well as information on how you can track him down to come speak. He goes around speaking with his fellow former Olympian, John Neighbor. We'll talk to John a little later in the program. But I think you're getting a taste of the energy, the enthusiasm that Louis Zamperini has. And now I want to hear more about his story of survival. We talked about that incredibly close call that you had in the mission over Nauru back in 1943. Or I guess that was Christmas Eve of 42. But by May of 43, you had a mission that you probably didn't think was going to be as eventful as it turned into. You guys were out looking for another plane that had been shot down?
Yeah, it was a weird situation. When you go on a search mission, that's an all-day flight looking for enemy ships and enemy submarines. And when you get back, you get 2 days off. And we got back, and we were heading for the main gate when the operations officer drove out in a Jeep and told us to halt it. And they said a B-25 is reported going down 200 miles north of the island of Palmyra, and we want you to go look for him. Well, we knew our plane was being serviced. And he said, well, there's the Green Hornet. Well, nobody wanted to fly the Green Hornet. It couldn't get off of the ground with a bomb load. And when it did get off the ground, it was a musher. The tail was down, the nose was up. And he said, well, it passed inspection, and so that's like an order. So we decided to, go down and look for the B-25. And so another plane flew ahead of us from another field in Hawaii. And we got down just where the plane reported last, and we began to circle. Now, the cloud cover was broken cloud at 1,000 feet. Now, we fly a search mission at 1,000 feet so you can see something. However, because of the broken clouds, we couldn't really see the ocean, so we flew under. That put us down to 800 feet. And we're scanning the ocean, and suddenly the number one motor goes out. Well, that plane could hardly fly on four, so we're having a struggle. And just as they were trying to keep the plane straight and level and keep the altitude, the number two motor goes out. Well, with two motors on this plane, the Green Hornet just nosed over to the left wing down and just plowed right into the ocean and blew up. Pieces all over the place. Oxygen tank, gas tank, and what have you. And then, of course, the plane sank. But there were two life rafts that ejected from the plane automatically, and I was trapped in the waist section. My job is to hold a deflated raft in my arms in front of me, and as soon as we crashed, I ducked down low behind the tripod of the machine gun mount, and I ended up under the mount with the raft under my belly and my back up against the tripod. So I'm in there so solid, I doubt if two men could have got me out. And then the tail snapped off. When the tail snapped off, all the control wires go within an inch and a half of the tripod. And those are springy wires. They just curl up. They curled up all around me to make my situation even tougher. And I knew this was it. I knew that so I started to sink. And I felt my ears pop, so I knew I was down 20 feet. And then I kept sinking down into the darkness. And then I felt a terrible pain in my forehead. I don't know what that was, but it felt like someone hit me with a sledgehammer. And then I lost consciousness. Now, before I lost consciousness, I just said to myself, God, help me. And then I lost consciousness. And then while I'm still sinking to greater depths, even greater pressure, I'm conscious again. And just momentarily, I felt a kind of a euphoria that, hey, this is the afterlife. Because I knew there was no way I could get out. Then I realized I was still in the plane and I was fighting for air, so I started to flail around with my arms. I'm in the waist section of the ship, pitch dark, and my USC ring on my index finger snagged onto the waist window. And that's what I was looking for. And then I realized what it was. I pulled myself out, inflated my life jacket, swallowing everything. I swallowed gas, oil, and blood all the way to the surface, threw it all up. And then I came up and looked. I heard, help, help. So the pilot and tail gunner were over hanging onto a gas tank, and they saw me. And they called it, help, help. So the life raft was drifting away in the current, so I'm trying to catch the raft. But I'm fully clothed with shoes on, and I couldn't catch the raft. And I thought, this is it. We're dead. And then as I turned back to look at the pilot and the tail gunner, there's about 100-foot cord attached to the trigger on the CO2 cartridge on the raft, and it's also embedded in the fuselage of the ship, and that's what inflates that raft. Well, as I looked over towards the other two guys, the last 3 feet of that cord was going by my face, somewhat submerged. I couldn't really see it until it got close to me, and I grabbed that and reeled the raft back in, and that saved our lives, that raft. And then I wrote to my buddies that the pilot's head had two gashes, blood was spurting, arterial blood. And so I had to, first of all, get a compress made out of my T-shirt. And I took another T-shirt and tied that down tight. And the funny thing is, I heard a gurgling sound. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, and then I never heard another sound. So somebody had come to the surface, badly wounded, and just trying to say help, I guess. But it sounded gurgling. And then we couldn't find anything. So whoever it was, we just came to the surface momentarily and then sank. And so there's three of us now in the raft. And the tail gunner, within 30 minutes, he starts screaming, we're going to die, we're all going to die. And that was pathetic. And I turned to him and said, look, nobody's going to die. We'll be rescued this afternoon or tomorrow. Well, the next day, it settled down, Mac, and he wouldn't settle down. He kept screaming, so I tried to use psychology on him. I'd taken a course in psychology at USC, Psychology 51. It didn't work. So I threatened him. I said, when we're picked up, I'm making a report to the commander, and you'll be in real trouble. He kept on screaming, so I turned my back on him, and I came around with a backhand of my knuckles. I cracked him across the face. I knocked him on his butt. And he just lay there in complete contentment, like a half smile on his face. A week later, or 5 days later, I had to do the same thing again. And after that, no problem. In fact, he got better and better as we went along instead of worse and worse. I thought if anybody hallucinates, it'll be him. But we buried him on the 33rd day, and he was sharper than he's ever been in his life. We had a program of mental exercises every day during the whole trip of 47 days. And our minds kept improving more and more. In fact, we were sharper after 47 days than we were the day we crashed.
Well, and this is unbelievable, and I know you lived it, and you've told the story so many times, and you just described it. But I'm imagining myself as someone who doesn't know your story and hearing this, and I want to highlight here some of the things. There were 11 men on your crew. Three of you survived initially, and you just said 47 days. You had to survive for 47 days lost at sea. How did you do that?
Well, the will to live. And I have a lot of young people say, well, did you ever think about dying out there? I said, not once. We never talked about dying. We only talked about living. And that fortified our constitution, you see. And then we had every day without telling them, I would come up with mental exercises like memorizing songs. Okay, I would teach them the hit top 40 songs. The pilot's dad was a minister. He'd teach us the words to the songs in the hymnal book.
Mm-hmm.
And every day we'd have some exercise, thinking back as far as you can think. And what are you going to do after the war? Every day we had something to keep our minds occupied, because my professor at SC, Dr. Webster, told us in class that the brain is like a muscle. Unless you exercise it every day, it will atrophy. And so that was the number one thing, was that. And finally, they got brutally hungry, and they wanted to know how to make spaghetti and that. So I was a cook. My mother taught me how to cook when I was five. And so I started baking biscuits for them, three meals a day, and spaghetti in the evening, and the next day lasagna, and then gnocchi. And then they got real greedy. They wanted brunch. And so I started cooking brunch for them. But it seemed to help, you know.
That imagination's a powerful thing, isn't it?
So the idea is to keep your mind exercised. I've proved that our minds were sharper than when we started. We were taken to the death island, this execution island called Kwajalein, and we were taken into a highly skilled a panel of intelligence officers for grilling, and we were able to defeat them. Now, every time I was in there and I got back to my cell, I would lay there. I had nothing but time. I had constant diarrhea. I weighed 65 pounds. And the water they gave us to drink didn't do any good. It went right through us.
Now, 65 pounds. Before this, you weighed about 165, right?
Right.
Holy moly.
Anyway, the panel, we were able to defeat them on every account. Because we kept thinking of what they could ask us. Now, you had all day long to do that. For two or three days, then they called you back in, so we were ready for them. And they knew we were vulnerable, so they had white tablecloth. They had drinks, soda drinks, water, pastries, biscuits. They wouldn't give us any, waiting for us to answer the question properly. And so finally, after many days, I was able to get something to eat, because I told them the truth. They asked me, how many new airfields do they have on Oahu? Well, before I left Oahu, they built three mock fields with mock airplanes made out of plywood.
Uh-huh.
So I pretend I couldn't tell them. And then I'd give in a little bit. They kept after me, and I'd hold off again, and then I'd give in a little bit. And finally, I broke down and told them where the three new airfields were. But they were mock fields, so good luck.
Exactly.
And that way I got a biscuit.
Now, so you told your crewmates the day that you crashed that, yeah, we'll be rescued tomorrow or later today. You survived 47 days hoping to be rescued by friendly forces. It's the Japanese who end up finding you. They're interrogating you. You've gone from 165 pounds to 65. Yet it seems like the way you describe it now, you woke up every day energized to make it to the next day.
Right. Well, we had a strong will to live. There was no problem about that. We never thought about death or even talked about it. On the 27th day, that was our worst day on the 27th. That's when a plane flew over. It looked like a B-25 American plane. We shot flares to what had died in the ocean. The plane came down real low. We took our shirts off. We were waving and waving at them. And we knew we'd be rescued. And then we heard machine gun firing, and the bullets went right between our legs, and one hit the metal pump on one raft, and it tore the whole bottom of the raft out. So we only had one raft, three of us in that raft. Actually, 48 holes in that little raft, and none of us are touched by a bullet. You talk about another miracle, that was it.
Amen.
That went on for 30 minutes, of strafing, and then they finally open up their bomb bay doors and drop the depth charge. That the depth charge missed us about 50 feet, which would have killed us, but it failed to explode. So the bombardier improperly armed the bomb, and so fortunately we lived through that. And then it was a miserable time trying to patch that raft to keep it afloat because it was wrinkled, laying flat in the water, two sharks around us, and we had to keep pumping and pumping, and bubbles kept coming out. And then we just put as many patches on the top as we could, and then we got it in pretty good shape, and then we had to patch the bottom. Now, that's a trick. The raft is in two pieces. There's two tubes. We let the air out of one half, pulled it up, let it dry, and tried to put a patch on it while we're sitting on the other half. In the meantime, there was always two sharks, always two of them. I don't know why they don't come in threes. And they were coming up trying to get us from the rear. So the tail gunner's job was to have an oar, and he would jab them on the nose. There's something about a shark's nose that they don't like. As a matter of fact, they found out last year a great white, when they stuck his nose out of the water, they touched it with their hands, and he became docile. And so the trick is to get them on the nose. And so that's what I did underwater. I straight on the sharks, two of them, while the strafing was going on. And when I'd hit them on the nose, they'd take off. But they come back because they're still hungry. So the raft, we got in pretty good shape. We only had to pump up once every hour. And then of course, Mac died. On the 33rd date, I was surprised he lived that long.
So there were only two of you left. It's absolutely incredible. And I've been reading a book called Fatal Voyage about the survivors of the USS Indianapolis. I want to thank
you. Oh, that was brutal.
Well, and Adolfo Celaya, one of the survivors, was kind enough to share that with me. And thank you, Adolfo, for that. But they survived a fraction of the time in the water that you guys did. They were finally rescued after a week where you guys were in the water
for
over a month.
Raft. They were actually in the water with sharks all around them, and they'd be talking to his buddy, and the buddy would be pulled under. And they had a convention about 8 years ago in Newport Beach and invited me there as their guest. And that was really brutal. And I guess between them and some MacArthur, somebody fouled up and didn't keep track of the ship.
Yeah, there were some major mistakes there. You know, I know that your time's limited, Louis, and I don't want to accelerate you too far here, but you end up as a prisoner of war of the Japanese, and this is incredible to me as well. One of the gentlemen who ended up interrogating you was one of your USC classmates?
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to get the rest of that story when we come back. In the meantime, if you're on the Internet, cruise on over to KMJNow.com for a link to Louis's website, as well as a link to buying his book, Devil at My Heels, or that New York Times bestseller, Unbroken, about his incredible life. More with 94-year-old Louis Zamperini when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're running short on time, but we're going to have much more with Louis Zamperini on next week's program. Let's at least flesh out that twist we heard right before the commercial break, that when he became a prisoner of war, one of the Japanese interrogators turned out to be someone he had gone to school with at the University of Southern California. That was a man named James Sasaki. We'll let Louis pick up the story there as we learn that that connection and perhaps some of his athletic notoriety actually helped spare him from execution. So, Louis, tell me about this classmate of yours, Sasaki.
Well, this guy on the panel, he said, when you were entering USC in 36, I was graduating. He was on the interrogation panel. But then an officer from another division on Kwajalein, he followed American sports and USC football and the Olympics. And so he came to the panel and said, instead of executing, our day of execution was already set. And anyway, he said it would better serve Japan's purpose to send him on to Japan to make propaganda broadcasts. Well, it made sense. I said, hey, great idea. So we got to go to Japan. And then, sure enough, they asked me to make a broadcast to my parents, which I wrote. And then they said, oh, you have beautiful radio voice. We want you to make another broadcast. At this time, they wrote the script, and it was propaganda, and I refused. And I think that's what Laura meant by being unbroken. On the raft and unbroken here, because they had me severely punished on a daily basis because I wouldn't make the broadcast, and then they finally sent me to a slave labor camp, and I still wouldn't give in. And the war ended there at Camp 4B in Nowetsu, about 35 miles from Nagano, where the Olympics were held.
Yeah, and there's a story there, too. And now you talk about that first broadcast that you got to make for your parents' benefit. Now, at that time, they believed that you had died, right?
Yeah, but the broadcast was so scrambly, the government wouldn't accept it as me. My parents were pretty sure it was me because I mentioned a few items that only they knew. But it was so incoherent that the government, that the Army said, no, there's no proof that he's alive, and so they kept me dead.
Wow. This is Louis Zamperini. He mentioned Unbroken. That, of course, the title of the best-selling book by Laura Hillenbrand, who also wrote Seabiscuit and another fast finisher in Louis Zamperini, her newest topic. His book is Devil at My Heels, or that other title, the alternate title, Death is My Companion. Louis Zamperini, full of life, and obviously you had to be to survive everything you did. You're captured in July of 43. Of course, the war doesn't end until 1945, more than 2 years in captivity. What was the hardest thing to endure that the Japanese did to you? What was the toughest thing for you to overcome?
Well, everything. I, on a daily basis, I'm beaten, and so I have to keep as far away from Watanabe, the bird we called him.
The bird, Watanabe, is a central figure to this story, someone we'll hear much more about on next week's program, as Louis will go into detail about some of the brutality he suffered at the hands of the bird. But the beauty of it is that is not the end of the story. To me, one of the most inspiring elements to Louis' story is the grace and forgiveness that he's extended to people who tortured him. And we'll get a taste of that next week on Hometown Heroes. I hope in the meantime you'll visit our website, kmjnow.com. That's kmjnow.com, for links to all kinds of information on Louis. And if you were captivated by his story today the way that I was, you're not going to want to miss the show next Saturday at 1 o'clock. Louis will talk about the beatings he received in captivity, yes, but we'll move on from there to the incredible high he experienced in being liberated. He'll also describe in detail the personal transformation that sent him on a new kind of journey that since then has impacted people all over the globe. We'll also hear from John Neighbor. Remember that name, John Neighbor? He won 4 gold medals in swimming at the 1976 Olympics. He might be the best backstroker of all time. And since then, he's become an all-star in broadcasting. You've probably seen him on television a time or two. He and Louis share their Olympic heritage. They're also both USC Trojan alums. But John's going to tell us why he has joined forces with Louis and how you could get the both of them to come speak if you're interested. I apologize for having to stretch this story over 2 weeks. We rarely do that here on Hometown Heroes, but let's make the best of it. If you enjoyed the program today, tell your friends about it. Tell them to go buy the book Unbroken or Louis's book Devil at My Heels. Have them go to kmjnow.com and listen to the podcast of today's show. It's already up there. And then we'll all be ready to hear lucky Louis Zamperini share the rest of his one-of-a-kind journey next Saturday afternoon. Thanks for listening today to Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.